to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois. Really excited today to be back with another episode talking New Testament studies, getting back into some ancient history in order for us to understand God's Word more fully and to understand it better and become even more faithful followers of Christ, we pray. And to do that, we have with us, welcoming back to the program, Adam York. Adam is the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. Yes, the church where I serve. And but he's the pastor now, calling all the shots. Welcome back, yeah. Adam. It's great to see you.
Good indeed to be here, Camden.
Yes, people will recognize the room, the bookshelves, and whatnot. Adam, I couldn't be happier to have you in Grays Lake, and I'm glad that to have you back even today to kind of jump in on this panel. I know your key interest is in New Testament. If you were to do some further studies, and maybe that'll happen someday, I know this is kind of up your alley. So I'm glad to have you with us, and I'm sure the listeners are glad to have you back with us too.
Yeah, just so glad to be here. It's a delight.
Praise the Lord. Well, we have with us today, welcoming to the program for the very first time, Dr. Bradley J. Bittner, who is now Associate Professor of New Testament at Westminster Seminary, California. If you subscribe to any of the newsletters or email newsletters out at Westminster, you'll know they've hired two new professors that we started back in July. Brad is one. I believe Nick Brennan is the other. We hope to talk to him sometime soon. But today we're talking to Brad and NT. Welcome, Brad. It's so good to see you.
Welcome. Hello. Thanks for having me.
You bet. We're delighted to speak with you. Really excited to talk all sorts of things about 1 Corinthians in particular. Brad most recently had been serving as lecturer in New Testament Greek and Biblical Theology at Oak Hill College in London, at least since 2014, and has written several articles and even books. But today we're going to be focusing on a book he wrote and was published with Cambridge University Press titled Paul's Political Strategy in 1 Corinthians 1:1 through 4:6, Constitution and Covenant. So maybe I'll title this Constitution and Covenant. We'll get a whole host of all sorts of like culture warriors coming to listen to this episode. But I love this book. I feel like I need several years to just get up to speed with everything going on in here because of the depth of the scholarship and the study, getting into Rome and Corinth and all the particulars there. Really was enlightening to see the kinds of metaphors and things that Paul was using in 1 Corinthians. So we're going to open that up today and to discuss these matters. But I do want to whet some people's appetite and at least give you opportunity, Brad, to speak about some of your other projects, because I know you're a big fan and a devotee of Gerhardus Voss.
That's right. Yeah. So I've really enjoyed and been blessed by Voss since my seminary days at Gordon-Conwell back in the late 90s. And I've continued a kind of sideline of projects on Voss. So I'm hoping some of those might see the light of day in the next couple of years.
We'd love to talk to you more about that and to share our mutual admiration for what many believe is the father of Reformed biblical theology. And we know there's a good tradition of that, and many of our friends out of Westminster Seminary, California, also interested in biblical theology and looking at the grand sweep of covenant history, how God has been working among his people. So we're very encouraged there. How have things been going for you? Do you feel like you're starting to settle in now? I mean, it must be very difficult to have moved overseas. I know you're back here in the States, but now to move back to the States and move to California and to settle into a new position all during a pandemic must be rather challenging.
Yeah, I told somebody recently, remind me never again to move a family of nine internationally during a global pandemic, because it was quite a feat just to get here. But the Lord is really kind. We got out, got two emergency passports in London at the U.S. Embassy 3 days before we flew, and we got here, and we've been really warmly welcomed by folks here in Escondido. So really glad to be here and grateful for the privilege of joining the team.
I don't know what the prospects are, but I just received an email from Westminster that the annual faculty conference, again, scheduled for January. I very much hope that perhaps any Californian restrictions will be low and things will be safe, that we could have that in person. But I had such a wonderful time back in January. I would encourage people to take a look at wscal.edu for updates on that. And I believe registration is either open now or it will be soon. So that's always a fun time. And if you'd like to meet the faculty even say hi to Brad, our guest, then that's probably a good way to do it.
And hopefully we can be back. San Diego's lovely in January, especially by comparison to maybe Chicago.
Right. Yes, Brad and I were talking in advance because he grew up in Peoria, Illinois, which is in central Illinois, a few hours outside of Chicago. And everything's in relation to Chicago and in Illinois. But that was an extra motivation for me to come to the conference. And it was very nice to come, 60 degrees. I think we got in the 70s here and there, at least close to it. Much more pleasant than what I was experiencing. Oh, wonderful. What's it like in Corinth? And there's a real clumsy, obtuse transition. But what's it like in Corinth in January? What is the Mediterranean there like? Any idea?
I have no idea, actually. Yeah. But I guess it would be maybe fairly similar to San Diego. I've only ever been in Corinth in the middle of summer, and it was pretty hot.
It must be. Yeah. Can you describe a little bit of the geography for folks who may not know? Because I'd love to open up, into your book, but just for starters, obviously, Paul wrote two letters, at least some people think three, or at least, trying to find the third one. and he wrote them to believers in Corinth, but, we may be familiar with that city, but not know exactly where it is on the map.
Sure. Yeah. If you can picture Greece, perhaps in the Mediterranean there, and think of Athens as a central city, and then you travel down, so south from Athens, onto the Peloponnesian Peninsula, so the Peloponnese, and Corinth sits right there on the isthmus, the little connecting bit of land. So it was an important area, important spot for trade, for economics, politics, as things progressed over the centuries there. And it's about, an hour train ride now from modern Athens down to Corinth. There's a new Corinth. Right. A modern city right on the shore, and then you travel a bit inland to Old Corinth, and the American School of Archaeology, based out of Princeton and elsewhere, has done all the excavating on site over the last century and a bit.
Yeah, I was surprised to see, I think the Old Corinth is maybe 5 kilometers away. Did that shift merely happen because you can't just build a new city on top of ancient ruins, or was it desirous to be in perhaps just a slightly different area? I'm curious how that new city eventually arose where it did.
Yeah, I don't know the full history of that, but I gather it's probably a mix of land ownership and where they develop things and where the shorelines are. I know when you go to Lycaon, the little bit on the coast there where Paul takes a vow near Kynchrea, Lycaon area, that you can see how the shoreline has moved over time, and some of what once was above the water is now underwater. So archaeology gets complicated there.
Yeah. Well, as I open this book, it's interesting to consider all the different factors involved here. We have issues regarding Greece, Rome, all the political aspects of that. But we start to talk about the life of the polis or the city, and then all of the various political things going on there, intertwined with architecture. You're bringing in notions of covenant and the covenantal community in Jeremiah and Septuagint translations. This is a complex of factors, but it really, in many ways, brings to light some things we might not notice immediately on a first or even a tenth read of Corinthians that original readers certainly would have known. Paul seems to, especially in 1 Corinthians 3 through 4, he's talking about Apollos, and one waters, one sows, one waters, then you have reaping, and he's talking about the skilled master builder. That whole portion of the book, it seems as if Paul is using some very common or understood city metaphors to his original readers that are not entirely lost on us. It's not hard to follow what he's saying ultimately, but we're lacking some of the depth and the contours of the argument, so to speak. You write, this investigation contributes to scholarship on both Roman Corinth and 1 Corinthians. However, its principal focus is the interface of two distinct politeiae in the text of the epistle. What are politeiae, at least within this context, and how is that important for us to understand?
Sure. So politeia is a kind of flexible Greek word. But I think some of the helpful ways to translate it are, it can be a constitution. So the constitution, and not just a document, like we think of the American Constitution enshrined, you know, on parchment or something, but a constitution, a set of laws that structures the public life of a city, or in this case, a Roman colony. So Corinth is refounded in 44 BC by Julius Caesar as a Roman colony with a Roman constitution. So you've got an interface of Greek and Roman law. Politeia can also be, so Paul uses the term in Philippians chapter 1 to talk about your public way of living and how you conduct yourself in public life. So it's a nicely flexible term, and I think it works especially well as a kind of heuristic lens when we come to the Corinthian letters to think about how are we supposed to understand life in the church versus life in the colony. And those obviously overlap for people then as they do now.
Sure. Yeah, you also start to reference your main hypothesis here along these same lines, and that you're really arguing, as far as I understand, that both constitution and covenant are essential to the necessary categories to interpret Paul here in 1 Corinthians. So we can understand the notion of covenant. We're all covenantal theologians and love that. But constitution here is important. So can you help clarify this, or at least set us up in the right trajectory as we proceed, so we don't get the wrong idea of some sort of like, you know, theonomic world order or something like that going on?
Absolutely. Yes. I don't want to go there. maybe a little bit of a tiny bit of background of what led me to this research question might be helpful at this stage. So, you know, I'd come, as we mentioned, I had cut my teeth on Voss with people like Greg Beale and Rick Lintz during my time at seminary, and also enjoyed Meredith Klein and his work on ancient Near Eastern covenants and how those at certain points can be really helpful for understanding Old Testament covenants. But I was left with this question, you know, if Paul wanted to communicate to some of the churches he was founding, the notion of covenant community and how, well, as he does in 1 Corinthians, he makes appeal at several points. Chapter 10 would be a good example where he says, you know, look back at Israel and what they did in the wilderness and how they sinned. Don't be like them. But he almost talks to the Corinthians as though they are one with these Israelites. There's a connection between God's old covenant and new covenant people. So I just wondered, how would you communicate covenant community as a concept to a mixed Jewish, Greek, Roman audience in Corinth? And it struck me that, you know, ancient Near Eastern treaty forms is not going to translate very well. But nobody knows Berit and all the different kinds of things. That's just not going to work. So that was one question that led me. How would you, what's a kind of first century Greco-Roman analog for thinking about constituted or covenanted community? And it turns out there are all kinds of ways, you know, that you could do that. You could have private associations, you could have cities, you could have different classes of Roman towns or colonies. And each of these seem to be models in some ways that were there for not just Paul and early Christians to think with, but there's a great book that argues in relation to the Qumran community that these public and legal political models from the larger culture supply metaphors, ways of thinking for alternative civic assemblies. So it's not as though we're saying the church is theonomic or something like that. It's rather, how do you conceive of an authority structure within the church? There is one, Paul says, and how do you think about the politics of the church, in quotes, in relation to its ethics? And I think that's very much on Paul's mind in 1 Corinthians.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could speak more of, you mentioned already, of the Roman character of the city here, but when it was founded as a Roman colony, Corinth needed to have a constitution, not just for its own governance, but also for its relation to the Roman Empire as a whole. Do we find a strong similarity? Is this something like there's boilerplate constitution that the emperor just issues, or is there great diversity among colonies in the Roman Empire?
Yeah, there's certainly diversity. I mean, there's an old 19th century, you know, German scholar who says that there's a kind of template for colonies, and he's drawing in part on an early writer who seems to suggest that. But when you start poking at colonies, so Philippi and Corinth. Yes, they're both Roman colonies, but they're in different places. They're founded at slightly different times. Philippi is much more of a military colony, so retired Roman army folks can go there, get a plot of land, and set up shop. And that's a very different kind of colony to what Corinth was founded as. So I think we have to be sensitive to the local and regional nuances and test that hypothesis that there's a colonial template. But in the case of Corinth, we do have wonderfully two other places that are founded at exactly the same time. So the trio of Carthage in North Africa, Urso, which was a city in southern Spain, and Corinth, all founded contemporaneously and all on the same legal template by Julius Caesar in 44.
Wow. How did this constitution function? Because it seemed like it transcended just the legal aspects of something we might imagine. And even in the United States, obviously our constitution governs what we do, but there's also this somewhat mythological, you know, dimension to it. There can be an aspirational dimension to it. And in other regards, it seems as if in Corinth, there's also a ritual aspect or a ritual foundation to this constitution. How did that function in the day-to-day life of the citizens?
Yeah, I think that's a big question, because there would be some who probably would look at my argument and say, oh, come on, you know, this is this is a bronze inscription. It's highly technical legal language, even, punctuated legal language. So if you imagine a text message today with lots of abbreviations, you've got to decipher this. And so this is an elite text. How does this have any traction for day-to-day life? So that was a question I had to grapple with.
Sure.
And I think you can actually demonstrate that the Constitution in a Roman colony is a living text in a way. It's not, so we have to set aside our American constitutional thinking a little bit at this point. We know that it's founded in 44, so it's got to have a constitution then. That is, as you say, part of the ritual of founding, it turns out. So there are sacrifices that are made, there are priests that are present.
Oh, wow.
There are boundaries that are marked out ritually around the limits of the colony. You can't bury anybody within those limits because you're going to desecrate the colony, the colonial space. And part of that whole ritual package is the giving of this colonial constitution by the founder. So Julius Caesar, the big name founder, but he would have sent out some high level Romans to go and be his representatives there. And we don't know whether the text itself was actually inscribed right at the beginning. We can make a good assumption that it would have been in place by the time Paul's there. But one of the things I was able to work out on the basis of the existing constitutions from Roman Spain is that these colonial constitutions are updated from time to time. And every time they're updated, it's a full update. And you pull the thing off the wall,
whoa,
you re-inscribe it, you put it back up. And we're talking, 13 meter, 40 Roman feet across a big public wall of bronze tablets inscribed with little letters. So it's a symbol, just like when you go to Washington, D.C., or you go to a major American city and you see some of these.
Or Philadelphia. It's Constitution Center. We have a whole center devoted to it.
but it's not only symbolic, I argue in the book, because you can get off the beaten path outside the elite center of Corinth, and you can see how the Constitution is governing things like workers digging ditches for drain water or laying out roads, or how and what time of day you can bring wagons loaded with supplies into the city. So there are dozens and dozens of chapters in these constitutions, and we know from a variety of angles that they do interface with the day-to-day life of the people who live there.
And Brad, if I can interject, so what were and maybe how many were these archaeological, these epigraphical sources that you were looking at, particularly in Corinth? And I know you mentioned a number of others across the Mediterranean, but what were some of the primary ones?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed this, but sort of had to take a deep dive. My training, I'd done some history, as an undergrad, but was mainly trained in theology. And so it was a great opportunity to learn where I studied in Sydney, Australia at Macquarie University from some excellent archaeologists and epigraphists, the people who deal with these inscribed texts. And so there's a whole set wonderfully published and all in English because it's the American school at Corinth of inscriptions that you can comb through. And part of what I tried to do was triangulate. So we've got the Roman evidence from Spain on bronze tablets, but how do we know that that has resonance and purchase in Corinth? We know, but we have a firm assumption it had to be there, but how can we anchor that? And so I dug into things like dedications on statue bases or on other small temples in Corinth. I looked at how the Forum, that central agora space where the famous Bema scene with Gallio takes place in Acts. How is that laid out? How's that oriented? What are the sight lines? You know, what do people see as they come in there? And tried to use both the textual evidence from the inscriptions, but also the archaeological evidence of the layout of the city to find a home, really, find a place for where this constitution would have been physically located. And then also to think about how it radiates out in its effect on day-to-day life when we see other inscriptions and other evidence around the city in various places.
Speaking of the actual text of 1 Corinthians, it's important, obviously, when we're interpreting to understand the shape, the flow of the text as a whole. Can you describe 1 Corinthians 1 through 4 in relation to the entire book, but then specifically 3:5 through 4:5, because that's really where we're going to focus, I believe.
Sure. Yeah, I think, I mean, you can slice it in different ways. There have been a lot of studies on 1 to 4, and some of them, I'm sure, like mine, it's just because you run out of words. You know, I wanted to do chapters 1 to 6, but there's not enough space in the dissertation. So 1 to 4 is a nice division. Some people would take it all the way to the end of chapter 4. Others might slice it differently. I think it's a helpful division because Paul, in my view, is making an apology. That is, he's not apologizing, but he's making a defense for his apostolic authority and gospel because not Apollos himself, but I think some people who were enamored with Apollos and maybe others have been pushing back against Paul. And for whatever reason, he's not got their support. So he starts out by making that defense. And I think, and chapter 4, verse 6, I think becomes really important. That's a very difficult verse. I've got a whole excursus in the book on it. But in my view, that helps. That's a kind of hermeneutical key for understanding what Paul's done up to that point. And I think he's after this key aspect of what's the properly wise way, that is the spiritually wise way to evaluate Christ, the word of the cross, but also his ministers and their gospel. So really, what's the spiritual way to evaluate Paul and his gospel, what he calls the foundation he laid as a master builder, which is Christ. So I think that's a big issue, properly spiritual wise evaluation in chapters 1 to 4. And then once he lays that out, he begins to respond to some of the things they've raised in their embassy with Chloe's people, sending back questions, and then also other things he knows they need to hear about. And he moves from politics to ethics. I think from in one to four, he's reminding them about the kind of political foundation. Now, this is not politics in the way the world thinks of it, but how did God found this koinonia? Chapter 1, verse 9. And I think we under-translate that if we go for fellowship. I think instead we're thinking covenanted community that they've been called into in union with Christ. How is that constituted and set up? And how is that meant to be built up? And now in chapters 5 and beyond, he really gets into some of the nitty-gritty of the ethics that should flow from the politics of the church. And another key issue others have pointed to is, you know, they've got bodies, and the bodies are in some ways the challenge for them in terms of sexual immorality, eating, purity laws, all the rest. And I think that's why chapter 15 becomes a really important capstone. What's the eschatology of the body in relation to Christ, who became a living spirit in chapter 15. So that's, yeah. I guess that's how I start to see the flow working itself out.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, I suppose some people might bristle at the use of the word politics, but then they might also be extremely supportive of a word like polity when we talk about like Presbyterian or church polity.
Exactly. Yeah,
something
yeah.
that's necessary.
That's right. And I think that's often what the way I try to explain it is, you know, I've been in the PCA for a long time. Most recently I was in the Free Church of Scotland. But in the PCA we've got our BCO, you know, we talk about church politics, and some people find that distasteful, but actually that's critical. This is how the Lord has structured his church. This is how it's meant to work. These are the ministers and their ministerial authority. We might get onto that later. But that's sure. what I mean by the politics of the church, kingdom politics, we might say.
Yeah. What's the immediate pressing issue here when Paul comes to, you know, his discourse in 3:5? What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you believed as the Lord assigned to each. How were the people tempted to view them, or at least what was the perception of these guys?
I think 4:6 becomes really helpful because Paul says, "This is what I've been doing in 3:5 to 4:5. These things, tauta in Greek, I have remodeled." It's a tricky verb, but I translate it remodeled on the basis of some other lexical evidence, and I think that's a kind of. It's a really clever pun in a way. He's saying, I've used a building metaphor, an extended building metaphor, to remodel what? To remodel these things with relation to myself and Apollos and your view of us. So I think it's, again, this issue of evaluation. They're placing certain ministers on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. So ancient celebrity culture, right. which has got some resonances with our own time and place.
Yes.
And they're not looking at ministers. They're not looking at ministry. They're not looking at the church in a properly spiritual way.
Would this have, now we're going to unpack quite a bit of the metaphor that Paul uses and its points of contact with Corinthian society and the Corinthian constitution. Are there points of contact with, or I should put it this way, are there cultural reasons for them to be viewing them this way? Were there people like super apostles or just celebrities in general that they would have looked to, or orators or something of the sort, where they was that prominent in Corinthian society, or is it some anomaly within the church?
No, I think you're exactly right to say it's prominent. And I've been influenced here by a scholar by the name of Bruce Winter. He was the one who introduced me to Corinth, took me on my first visit. And he's written quite a lot about this. And there's another Australian by the name of Jim Harrison, who's just come out with a more Zeebeck volume on Paul and the celebrity circuit, and Corinth figures in that. So that's absolutely the case. You've got people who are very well spoken, rhetorically highly trained, good looking, you know, often in a physical way as well. And these are the people who seem to be getting a lot of acclaim and attention. Wealth plays into the picture, as it often does. Education. So that's very much operative in first century Corinth.
I imagine many people read a lot into this, and sometimes you end up with these psychologized, you know, biographies of various biblical figures. But kind of the caricature is that Apollos, there's great evidence that he was well educated at a, you know, most likely a very good, you know, oratory skill. And his language was highly developed and theological acumen very keen, as we see in Acts. And then when the Priscilla and Aquila helped instruct him, he taught the word of God, preached Christ more accurately rather than having kind of like an old covenant view. And then the caricature of Paul is that, you know, there's not much to look at. His outward appearance is, you know, maybe, you know, less than desirable. We don't know all of the features of Paul. We don't have a picture or a recording, but a lot of people like to read into that. And perhaps, I don't know if there's something here or if we're just making hay of it, where the comparison between Apollos and Paul would be rather stark, at least in the outward modes of comparison. But Paul wants to direct their attention back to what they're both seeking to do in terms of the kingdom of God.
Yeah, I think it's evident elsewhere, but especially in the Corinthian correspondence, you know, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, you get these glimpses that it may be too much to go with. There's an ancient tradition that says Paul is, you know, kind of the Christian Socrates, and he's a hunchback and portrayed as really ugly, but really wise. Now, I think that's overplaying it a little bit. And we don't know if it was a physical ailment or whatever, but what we do know is whatever he was like, the Corinthians reacted really strongly to that. And he almost seizes on it as a matter of pride. You know, mm-hmm. in 2 Corinthians, he's going to say, I bear in my body the death of Christ. And he takes a proper pride, it seems, in his weakness, both a weakness of how he appears, a weakness of how he maybe communicates in person, orally. You know, they write to him, you're very strong, when you come across strongly in your letters, but come on, you know, come talk to us, and you're pretty weak. So that seems to have really given rise to a strong reaction. And I think that's why he's starting, as he does in 1-4, to reconfigure, to remodel what should be the proper paradigm for evaluating God's apostolic gospel and his apostolic ministry.
Mm. Let's get up to speed a little bit on the scholarship of 3:5-4:5. I know we don't need to rehearse the whole thing, and I strongly encourage people to pick up a copy of the book if you want to get down into the details, or at least find one in your library. And if your library doesn't have one, tell them to buy one. But where do you find your study in the flow of scholarship? Has this been a constant focus, or are you picking up some themes that kind of been left by the wayside for a few decades or centuries?
No, I think I very much tried to follow the trails that were made before me. I think that's just a wise thing to do. You know, you don't want to chart off
of course.
On a completely.
I guess course. I'm asking if there were recent trails or if you're.
No. I was going to say that even though I tried to do that, there was one anonymous reader I remember of the manuscript who liked it. That's why it got published. But he also said, wow, this is sort of out of left field, this approach. I don't know if that's a compliment or if that's a criticism.
If you want to say it in a Corinthian, you know, sophistic way, I guess you would say this is an orthogonal study.
There you go. So yes, I was trying to pick up on several different lines that seemed promising to me. So I had biblical theology in mind, and I'd been taught by Greg Beale, inspired by him to think about the church as temple and the temple metaphor right through biblical theology for God's people. And he talks about properly, I think, finding that in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. So that was in the background for me. And then on the more Greco-Roman side, people like Bruce Winter and others had been saying for a while, well, we could reconstruct the Corinthian constitution, and that would give us some insight into what Bruce calls the underlays of conflict and compromise. You know, we can see on the surface some of the results of conflict in the Corinthian church, and some of the presenting symptoms of ethical compromise in their cultural setting. But could we get underneath that? And so a lot of people had made gestures towards the constitution. So I was trying to pick that up as well. And then the more I dug, the more I realized there had been so much helpful scholarship looking at the two sections of text that I was focusing on, including this one, 3:5-4:5, where the pieces were there, but it seemed like they hadn't quite been brought together, and the picture wasn't quite in focus. So temples being built in Corinth, a building boom in the mid-50s, the biblical theological piece, epigraphical studies. So I tried to just bring those together in a helpful way.
So where do you see your studies and how you are bringing into view certain archaeological studies, epigraphical studies to some other currents that you would have, I suppose as a good Vossian thinking about the Aeonic interplay going on in, from chapter one onward, and two, somewhat in three as well. Where's the interplay and the connection of those things?
Yeah, because of the need to focus, I felt like I was constantly having to leave to one side some of the biblical theological things I would have liked to have done in this book, hoping to be able to come back to that as I am slotted, I hope, next year to teach out here at Westminster Seminary, California, an elective on the Corinthian correspondence. And that's one of the things I want to pick up there. I think at one point I tried to sneak in a few seeds of it, even though I wasn't really supposed to in the book that we've got here, especially from chapter one in the Thanksgiving period, is from 1:4-9 is one of the places where I spend a lot of time, because I think there's a strong connection. Others had pointed to this too, that 1:4-9, where Paul thanks God for very particular things, and others have said this is, you know, the Thanksgivings of Paul's letters are hermeneutical seedbeds that then blossom in the rest of the epistle. I think that's right. But there's a particularly strong connection and blossoming when you move from the Thanksgiving period in 1 Corinthians then to chapter 3. And in biblical theological terms, I think we've got in the Thanksgiving period an eruption of God's divine kingdom. He expresses that with this term koinonia in 1:9. And it's configured in a particular way in Corinth, and I think 1:6 becomes really important here. A lot of debate about this little phrase, the testimony of Christ, and what that genitive, so a construction in Greek, what does that quite mean? And I think, and I've tried to show in the book, that there are real resonances here as well in a place like Corinth that point to the fact that the way God has founded this erupting community of his people in Corinth is by having Paul step in there and proclaim this word of the cross, which is a testimonial about Christ. Christ as really a kind of patron for the church, similar but different to the way the colony would have had powerful patrons. Of course, Christ is an absurd patron from a Greco-Roman standpoint. He's been crucified like a slave on the cross, and yet Paul says, it's his merits, it's his person and work, which is the founding reality and the empowering reality for this group at Corinth. And when you had a testimonial, you would, in a place like Corinth, you would read that out publicly. There would be lots of shouts of acclaim, and then you would inscribe it on a monument publicly to capture it. And I think he moves from this testimonial about Christ being announced in 1:6, then to 3:5-4:5, mm-hmm. shows us the building. He shows us the structure on which the glory of Christ, the mediator, is being inscribed. And it's a non-physical temple. It's the church itself, indwelt by the Holy Spirit, which is rising to the glory of the patron of this really odd little group in the middle of Corinth, you know, who have no worldly glory, but they have a different kind of inaugurated glory. Yeah. In 1 Corinthians.
Well, that's that distinct distinct aeon, but we also see that clash of politeia, the distinct way of understanding this realm in which we inhabit. We're ultimately citizens of heaven, not citizens of earth. That doesn't mean that we should be absent of the earth or, you know, seek to have nothing to do with it, but we should be faithful to our Lord wherever he places us. This is the fascinating thing, but then to think of how Paul communicates that truth in this culturally accommodated way, to use this cultural metaphor to get across these deep spiritual truths so that the people of Corinth can quite understand, and in many ways playing off on their expectations culturally to kind of shock them, and they can see the great difference that is Christ. Christ isn't supposed to be the emperor of Rome. He's not supposed to look like it. Although he is Lord of Lords, King of Kings, and Lord of Lords, he's so different because this whole order and God's wisdom is different from the wisdom of this world. That's where this is so fascinating, to see all the details of this culture and this history coming out in great ways. I'm rambling here, but I want to put our focus here on this complex cultural metaphor, especially on Paul's use of the phrase skilled master builder, which, you know, we can take that or leave that in terms of its translation, but here in the Greek, hos sophos architekton. What's Paul getting at there? And then, you know, if you would, fill in the gaps for us, because people might just read that and move on, but this is a highly developed position within the whole politics of construction within the city, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think to lay out just a little bit of the trails that led me to realize that myself, I had, again, in mind lots of Old Testament background. I like to talk, as you'll know from the book, about Old Testament background.
Yeah, we get to Jeremiah.
Which is really important and in many ways far more important than whatever else is going on in the culture in terms of our theological place to land.
Right.
And then think about cultural foreground. So a Corinthian foreground, an Old Testament background. And so I think Paul's got lots he wants to say as the apostle who knows his Old Testament, who knows the gospel of Christ. We can get to this, but I think he conceives of himself in terms of Jeremiah, especially in the Corinthian correspondence. But how is he going to communicate that? How is he going to bring that across? And I think there is a sense in which he's just a really good communicator and observer as he moves through the Greco-Roman world. There are some scholars who want to say, no, Paul misunderstands the Corinthians. And I want to say, absolutely not. I think he gets it, and he works really hard to make his communication clear to them. And the way he does that in this text, 1 Corinthians 3:5 to 4:5, is by weaving together an incredibly rich and complex cultural metaphor, as you said. And one way I would differ with interpreters that I respect, so somebody like a Gordon Fee, whose commentary is still really, really valuable. But Fee would say, when you start in there, you know, Paul planted, Apollos watered, and then we move from planting and watering to building, that those are just individual disconnected metaphors. They're ornamental. And Paul does this. People say he shifts metaphors. I don't think so. I think once we understand how metaphor works, and also when we remember 4:6 tells us these things and reaches all the way back to 3:5, that 3:5 to 4:5, every little piece has its place if only we can kind of get under the hood and understand how temple construction works with its social dynamics, its power dynamics, its funding, lines of glory and authority. So all of that gets wrapped up here in what Paul does. And one central node, as you've pointed to, is 3:10. Paul says, I'm the master builder. I'm the architect. And the term he uses there would have communicated he's the one who has been commissioned. I mean, he says that himself, that he's been given this commission. And as the commissioned architect, he's not the one who gets the glory, but he is the one who has the authority. And it's an authority to make sure the building project proceeds exactly according to divine specifications in this case. And he's not going to brook any kind of shoddy work as he looks around, not because it's his project, but because he's got that role. He's been assigned as the architect.
Yeah, there's so much to follow up on there. What other positions would there be in this politics of construction? I mean, fill this out for us, if you would. We have the skilled master builder, the architect, Sophos architect, wise architect. I don't know if that would be appropriate within the semantic usage there, but who else is involved? You mentioned earlier the patrons, but we're going to have various kinds of workers and what's involved in this construction, which again, according to the Constitution, certainly has a lot of ceremonial, even ritual aspects to it. We're not just talking about a job and a financial transaction.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great, maybe if I can, I'll outline the process. I'll try to keep it brief and then point to, I like pictures, even though I'm a textual guy, I really like pictures. And there's a great Roman relief that I'll tell you about.
Oh, so great.
In brief, the process is this. There's somebody with a lot of money and influence in the colony who says they're going to give that money for a building project. They're going to build a temple in the middle of the forum or off the side of the forum. And they get permission for this from the colonial magistrates. This is where the Constitution is a helpful frame to understand some of these legal dynamics, as well as the status involved. But that person with the money is not going to get his hands dirty. So they appoint an architect who actually leases the project. So he's awarded the project. You know, it's kind of a bidding process. And there's a lot of invidious competition for these projects, Plutarch tells us.
To be kind of like a general contractor, where we think of him that way, or you know, even
civic. A general contractor, but almost even more, because we know that the architect gets down and dirty with the men, with the workers. It doesn't just hang back, doesn't just supervise.
He's not merely a project manager and doing a financial deal and then having other people do the work. The skilled master builder would do the work too.
Exactly. Okay. And this becomes really key for what Paul's doing. He's not in an air-conditioned, you know, office somewhere, just sending people out to go and cut stones and lift things. He's actually out there on the work site. He's among the men. He's down there making sure it's happening, getting sweaty, getting dirty. And so the architect appointed with that authority doesn't even get paid very much more than the workers. So his status is and authority is higher because of the job he's given, but his pay is about the same. He's out there under the same working conditions. I think Paul, again, is making this point for a reason. And then you've got all kinds of different skilled workers on the job site, everything from stone cutters to carpenters to people who would inscribe the stones, mark it up, lift the stones. The Romans were great engineers, as we know, and so we can see them, you know, lifting incredibly heavy things. So the work site be a busy place. Importantly, you've also got not just that legal framework in the far background of the Constitution, but you've got specifications for the job, which are either written on a whitened board or inscribed on stone, and it's right there at the work site. And so if the architect's down there and he sees a workman making a bad cut on a stone and breaks the stone, he goes back and he points at the specifications and says, look, you've been penalized now. You've got to pay for that stone that you just ruined. And there's constant recourse being made, reference being made to the design specifications. And that's one of his roles. So it's a really dynamic kind of work site. And I think he's drawing on a lot of those dynamics in what we see in chapter 3.
So what vestiges do we have here of the koinonia or the covenantal community? You spoke of the foreground here of Corinth, but obviously there has to be a lot of overlap and connections with the background of the Old Testament and the covenantal documents. I mean, I can just see and feel the influence of Meredith Klein coming forth in your work, which I very much appreciate.
Yeah, and this is where I look to Jeremiah. I haven't convinced everybody, so you should know it's not won the day completely. But I think, look, you've got a temple, right? So temple right away activates all kinds of Old Testament background. And we know that even the materials Paul uses are resonant with Solomon's temple being built. But more than that, I think Paul, through 1st and 2nd Corinthians, he uses the language of planting and building at three points. Twice towards the end of 2nd Corinthians, chapter 10 and chapter 13. And then here, this is the first time. It's the least explicit, but I think it's an important one. And if you think about planting and building, that's not, for me, and I try to argue this in detail, takes us right back to Jeremiah's prophetic commission in Jeremiah 1:10, where he's commissioned, he's given the word of the Lord to do all kinds of heavy lifting, destroying kingdoms, but also building up. And Paul selects two of those verbs very carefully from Jeremiah. He shares them amongst himself and Apollos here, but then he takes them back to himself in a significant way, saying, look, if we're planting and we're building, then this is not just any temple. This is a garden city temple in the way that Klein and Beale would want to argue. And I hope my argument strengthens that line of biblical theological thinking. But I don't think Paul thought that would be immediately obvious and have the weight he wanted it to have in the Corinthian church. So as you move from 3:5 to 9 into 3:10 and following, I think he begins to shift gears. It's not an abrupt change of metaphor. It's just shifting the focus now from what we might say a light touch Old Testament background, Jeremianic planting, building of this garden temple, into what's really understandable for the people who are listening to him. That is, they walk by it every day and they see the construction site. And some of them might even be workers on a construction site, and they understand these dynamics of authority.
Well, you might be underselling yourself a little bit just in this conversation. I don't think at all in the book, but I think it's useful for people to know that Paul's explicitly referencing Jeremiah 1:10 in 2 Corinthians, at least in two spots, correct? I mean, so it definitely is something that, I mean, I hope at least scholars don't argue against those uses or that background in 2 Corinthians. But if that's on his mind with the same group of people, perhaps it's a leap, but at least it's germane to the conversation.
That's right. Yeah, I think absolutely so. It's just not quite as explicit in 1 Corinthians 3, but I think it's there. And I think he then pivots towards this foreground to make his point absolutely clear so that he can deconstruct their wrong way of evaluating.
Mm-hmm. I just remember when I was preaching through 2 Corinthians and making that connection really for the first time of that connection and contrast as Paul is the one seeking to build up and not tear down. But yet he will still come and bring a rod of judgment if necessary. Yes. But back for a moment to the Sophos architectone. I really wanted to chime in on that. And I'm just thinking this off the top of my head, so it may be of no value. But thinking about the Old Testament background for that, and particularly, I guess this is coming to my mind as I'm working through Exodus. And although God is the builder of the temple, he is giving this pattern to Moses such that it is to be built after the pattern that he's shown on the mountain. And then does Paul have perhaps an understanding as one of the apostles, is functioning in that way so as to be laying this foundation that is directed so that this new temple, the temple which is the church, is being built up in a way analogous to what was shown and how things were governed even under the old covenant there with Moses being granted a pattern to begin that building process, which it doesn't take an arbitrary shape. It takes shape according to the divine model. I don't know if that would have, you're making the connection to Jeremiah, and I'm wondering about some of these potential mosaic connections.
I love that, Adam. And in other presentations that I've made in friendly biblical theological settings, I absolutely go there. I think, the language there in Exodus 24, in the Greek translation, it's a tupos, it's a paradigma. So these are beautiful terms that then get picked up even by interpreters of Paul, like John Chrysostom says, what's Paul doing in this text? He's presenting first himself as a tupos, a pattern, but he then extends it and implies that Paul's presenting a building paradigm. And that's the way I like to think about it. This is Paul's paradigm for building up the church. And not just a paradigm in the general, American sense or whatever. We talk about paradigm shifts after Thomas Kuhn. It's instead thinking about an ancient paradigm, which could be a plastic model. And, just like Moses sees this paradigm in the glory cloud on Sinai, I think there are resonances there in from our biblical theology where Paul's saying, look, guys, Christ is the only thelelios. So that's the term he uses there. But that's a hugely important term, and it's been recognized as such, down through church history. And the reformers really pick up on this, that's not just a throwaway phrase. So Paul's the wise architect, but actually he wants to get the attention onto the foundation because it's Christ who's the paradigm. And it's not just a simple Jesus here. It's got lots of content, lots of doctrinal content, I'd want to argue, that Jesus as the foundation is akin to these specifications on the work site. And we're meant to understand Paul's preaching, his full gospel about Christ crucified and all the rest is packed in there. And that's the paradigm according to which the church is meant to be built up. And then, of course, indwelt by the Spirit, 3:16, 17, just like at the end of Exodus, when the glory Spirit comes to fill that temple, it's incredibly, this sinful, messed up church is already indwelt by this glory Spirit. So I think there are a lot of helpful resonances to work with there.
I feel like we're just given an abstract relative to, a 500-page book because we can't dive down into the details of this. I'd love to, continue and follow up our conversation at some point. But I know listeners can certainly pick up the book and read. But before we do go, I want to give you the opportunity at least to speak about some of the rhetorical features and the shape of, this portion of 1 Corinthians with reference to 4:6 as well, but you speak of the technical terms of evaluative judgment in the sweep from 3:5 to 4:5, but you also mention that not as many interpreters recognize the form and the function of the whole unit. Why does that matter? And what do you notice of this portion of 1 Corinthians that's significant that would help guide us as faithful biblical interpreters?
Yeah, I think I think as I've said, there's a nice rhetorical tip of the hat, and I'm borrowing that term from another scholar, David Koch, who was the first, I think, to really definitively show that 3:5 to 4:5 belongs together. And he says it's this tip of the hat in 4:6, which helps us see that.
The tauta, these things.
Right. Yeah. That's right. That I've remodeled these things, and that mm-hmm. reaches all the way back. Another scholar, Morna Hooker, that some people will know, used to be at Cambridge, says, look, it's the these things that are being remodeled for the sake of Paul and Apollos and their proper evaluation by you. So I think that's really key for us and needs a little bit more time to kind of think and understand as people come to this text. But then once you see that and you go back and try to join up the flow from 3:5 to 4:5, Paul, there is a nice flow section by section, and Koch outlines, you know, five subunits, but there's really a kind of double climax. So 3:18 to the end of the chapter is this beautiful, it's almost like a doxology. You know, God's given you everything. This divine benefactor, who's the one funding this building project, he's given you everything you need, everything that you need. You know, imagine having a church building project where there's no budget limit, no ceiling. You've just got a blank check to work with. And you know every day you're going to have all the tools, all the resources, all the funding, all the support that you need from the one that it matters from. I think that's what he's saying there. And that becomes, I hope, really encouraging to those who are in pastoral ministry, thinking, okay, this is, you know, I might be empty, running on empty, but the funder of this project is not. And this divine grace is just overflowing to me. So I think that becomes a helpful rhetorical observation that then is very practical for us. There's also a nice little section right towards the beginning where Paul plays with things in 3:6 and 3:7, and he ends in Greek with a very careful construction that's rhythmic, and it points out that God is the one who gives the growth. You know, so if I'm preaching on this section, my byline is going to be every time, the one who gives the growth gets the glory. Mm-hmm. Who gives the growth gets the glory. Because I think that's right. I think glory is actually really central here. Are we giving glory to Apollos? No. Does it go to Paul? No. It goes to the one who gives the growth. And this was a known acclamation in the first century. People would shout this term. It's from the verb auxano in Greek, and they would stand and shout this, among other things, when a building was dedicated or a local, you know, benefactor was being honored. I think Paul, right from the start, says, not me, not Apollos. The glory goes to the one who gives the growth. And mm-hmm. that little rhetorical observation, again, helps us keep the glory from ever resting where it doesn't belong in ministry.
Oh, that's so perfect. I mean, there's so many pastoral implications here, and I don't mean that only for pastors to use, but certainly pastoral shepherding implications for all Christians. The temptation for Paul in his flesh, according to his flesh, might have been to puff himself up. Well, if you guys like Apollos so much, well, let me tell you, you know, kind of like he has every reason. I mean, every earthly possibility of puffing himself up. He provides quite the resume in Philippians. He doesn't do so there to puff himself up, but he does it there to demonstrate the importance of justification and the righteousness of Christ. And knowing him is the most important thing of all. You could, all this other stuff, even these spectacular earthly achievements and pedigree, are garbage, rubbish compared to knowing Christ Jesus our Lord. What he does here in 3:5 to 4:5 is not try to level the playing field between him and Apollos in terms of earthly glory, in terms of them seeking their own glory, but he brings them both him and Apollos down in a God-centered way to speak about how they are servants. I see, you know, at least according to the English Standard Version, servants in 3:5, fellow workers in 3:9, and that the glory always goes to God, to Christ.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's, I mean, I like to summarize it sometimes briefly for people that I know will never read the book in these ways, you know, that what's the payoff of all this, you know, hundreds of pages of work. I hope the payoff is in part that we realize it's ministry, not magistracy. It's not actually, there's no glory authority. It's a ministerial authority that Paul and other ministers have. It's not leadership. Paul avoids the word for leadership strenuously. It's not leadership, it's labor. You know, ministry, really, really hard work, which is sobering for ministers, but also helpful for our congregations to know. And it's also, it's not competitive, it's collaborative. You know, he does bring himself together in a servile way, as servants together with others. So I think those are some of the things that we get as payoff. You know, ministry, what is ministry? If it's the major metaphor here, ministry is building work. It's building work. It's not, we could insert lots of other cultural, you know, substitutions for that. It's not military leadership, which sometimes in the UK it gets confused with. It's not managerial leadership, like some in the US might think.
Oh, goodness.
Ministry is building work. That's what Paul's point is, I think, here.
So if we want to write some works on ministry or how to be a faithful pastor, maybe we don't look to the business bestsellers list and managerial principles or Peter's whatever principles for leadership, whatever. We need to look to Christ and build according to his plan with his resources and with the Spirit that works in and through us. Realize it's not about us. It's about Christ and how we're united to him. And then fellow members with one another in that temple. Man, you're preaching. I love it. Yeah. This is great. This is a beautiful example where, you know, real heavy lifting scholarship really hits the road. This is the stuff that matters. And this is what scholarship should be doing. This is an example, I believe, Brad, of scholarship that's building in its own right, you know, according to God's plan. So thanks so much for writing this. Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing this with our listeners. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me and for that encouragement. That's the whole purpose behind it. But
amen.
It's great to know that it's
helping. Keep at it, brother. And you can find out more information, of course, about Dr. Bittner and his scholarship over at Westminster Seminary, California's website, wscal.edu. Especially take a look at the upcoming conference in January. It's a wonderful time there. You'll find information about that and other things on their website. You can also head on over to reformedforum.org, find out information about what we have in store, and subscribe to our email newsletter and our print newsletter that is going out in the mail. And people that have subscribed should probably, by the time this episode comes out, have received it in their post box, if the post office is still functioning. Who knows? Maybe you haven't received it yet. If you haven't and you subscribed, I'm blaming the post office. So it's not my fault. Anyway, take a look at what we got going on at reformedforum.org. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.